is very well known that everyone sings. I don't know what it is. But he said when he wrote that particular song, he'd either been writing, he must have been writing music, maybe he was writing a book. But he said he'd worked very late, he was very tired, he went to bed, he was trying to fall asleep, and the melody came to him. And his response was, "I'm too tired, I'm not interested." And he just kept trying to go to sleep, and as he said, it wouldn't let him go to sleep, so he just had to get up and write it out before he was allowed to sleep that night. And he thought also, there's a melody already to it, but anyway, so it's really such a gorgeous song. He also said, of course, we're singing it in a romantic context, but he said, really, it's just the song about lifelong friendship. So many of us on the spiritual path, you know, form these bonds that last for our whole lifetime through. And it just expresses that whole sentiment of sharing a life together. It's just a very touching melody. When he first wrote it, he couldn't sing it. He'd get about halfway through, and he would cry so much he couldn't sing it. And most people, when they would, many of the singers had a lot of trouble singing it at first because it would just move you so much you couldn't stop crying. It's very sweet. So now to today's. It's a perfect song for today. It's interesting. Also, a lot of different, mostly women, of course, have sung that song. And one of the nicest versions of it comes from a woman in Germany who lives in Italy, who's a German woman. Some of you know her, which is Maya Devi, because she's met her husband when they were 18 years old, and they've been together about 25 or 30 years now. Somehow when she sings it, just the depth of that comes through it so beautifully. So there's other people who sing it better, but people agree that she sings it best because there's just so much of her life in it. So. Today's chapter, which is called, before I go on, does anybody have any comments or questions from last week or the weeks before that I should deal with? You've been conspicuously silent in your questions. Maybe it's because so many of you are here as couples. Sometimes it's easier when it's just women, they'll ask more questions. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Last week you spoke about
body. Right. Take it in because it was icky, or take it in because you didn't want to expand that far?
Probably.
Okay.
It appeared to me icky. Mm-hmm. That's the way I judged it.
Mm-hmm. But, in the context where the person, where you really liked the person, though.
Yeah, I'm wondering if maybe it is.
At times. you know, you're saying take in another person's reality. Part of the reasons I asked you the questions is it's not really that you have to become that reality. You have to simply relate to it. You have to relate to it appropriately. That's quite different than making it your own reality. To be able to relate to someone else's reality appropriately doesn't necessarily imply any abandonment or diminishment of your commitment to your own reality. It's just that you also are able to see that, you know, if I was walking in those shoes, this is what the world would look like to me. It doesn't mean that you have to say, therefore, I have to say that's better or that's mine. You just have to relate to it appropriately. For example, if you're in a marriage and there's two of you and it's a 50-50 split and you see the world differently, there's simply no reason why yours should dominate. You know, that you have an equal opportunity to respond. So to relate appropriately is to say, you know, this is a cooperative effort. I have to see that for you this is what's true, and much of the time I have to just allow your reality to be the one that runs the show. The fear of it is, the fear of it is always. Because we are not sufficiently identified with our inner reality, and we are too strongly identified with our outer reality. And the extent to which that we think reality is my thoughts, my feelings, my opportunity to express myself, then when anything seems to impinge upon that, we believe that we're going to disappear. And so we have this mistaken idea of self-preservation. Yeah, I identified in my life something that I called my panic survival response. And it was an instinctive, not rational, generally not controllable feeling that if David's was allowed to do what he wanted to do, that I would cease to exist. Now, you know, and because we work together as well as live together, you know, there's just a lot of circumstances in our life where we don't always agree because we see the world very differently. And sometimes he would want to do something, you know, less, partly in our personal life, but more often in our, what I don't want to call it, our professional life, because it's also our personal life, but just some decision in relation to what we're doing. He would just feel strongly that this is how it should be done. And I would become persuaded that if his way dominated, then the entire world would expire, beginning with me. Right? Now, of course, rationally, that's impossible. But in fact, that would be, and I would be into my panic survival response before there was any rational step in the middle. And I began to realize that I would find myself doing and acting as if that we were in some hysterical life-threatening situation, when really we were just talking over some relatively simple matter, right? And so I began to look for clues. Clues such as, like that. That was one. That's me. And David's clue is more like this. Yeah, that was another, you know, just like all of a sudden we are not having a conversation. We are one of us like a chipmunk talking to a tree. Okay? That was a clue. And I began to see the repeating pattern that whenever the chipmunk was talking to the tree, probably we were out of proportion. But just calling it that in my own mind, and then stopping to ask myself, is this really a life-threatening situation? I was able to just put my hand over my mouth. And often I would have to walk away, because once you're in a life-threatening situation, it's not always easy to say, oh yeah, no threat. Sometimes it took a little more willpower than that. But I just began to know whenever the chipmunk was talking to the tree, something was totally wrong. And there was just no point in continuing on the subject, because we were so far off the subject that there was no hope, which is what Swami talks about in these chapters we're dealing with. Now, why do we feel that way? Past lives, past karma, karma in this life. I just call it Maya. At a certain point, I began to say, who cares why? You know, knowing why is really not the point. The point is to stop. And so I just called it delusion. I love the phrase, the devil made me do it. You know, it's like it's not my fault. It's just this cosmic ignorance that thinks that I'm so vulnerable that I have to constantly be shoring up this world, you know, and making everybody in it do just what I want. And I'd like to exaggerate the attitude, because when you're doing it, it doesn't feel that stupid, right? But if you can, like, type it, just type it and say, the facts don't matter. Once I am in that consciousness, I'm wrong. Now, I may be able to get out of that consciousness and get back to the facts, and there may actually be something to discuss. But then it won't be a chipmunk talking to a tree. It'll be an actual conversation about, you know, my point of view, your point of view, what that makes you feel like, what I feel like. And, you know, there's a real difference. You can have conversations. Now, not all people are really good at having conversations, so, you know, but there's certainly no hope when you're in that mode. You can analyze yourself and sort of notice what triggers you, but all it really comes down to is essentially what I've said. And it's classic. It doesn't need a specific explanation. If any of us are in it, it's because we've tuned in to this huge strata of delusion called, I can be so easily threatened if the world doesn't do exactly what I want, which is just probably not a happiness-producing attitude, because the chances are real good that the world is not going to do what you want. And it's a certainty that the people you love are not going to do what you want, unless you have married or live with somebody who has no energy, you know. I mean, you can find somebody who's so powerless and puny in themselves or sick in their mind that they will be your slave, but then you'll get bored with them. So what difference does it make? You know, it just won't work. Does that help? Yeah. Pam, were you going to ask?
Well, when you were doing the chipmunk, it was reminding me of a meditation, too.
Pardon me?
Sometimes it must feel threatened that the mind is just going...
Oh, yeah. Oh, while you're meditating.
Yeah.
Yes, you're trying to be the tree and your mind is the chipmunk. Yeah,
that's relationship there.
No, but that's true. You're right. Because all you're dealing with is this generic fear response that becomes hysterical over things. And, you know, women tend to get excited and men tend to, you know, women tend to turn into chipmunks and men tend to turn into trees. You know, but it's still... It's the same thing. Often men will turn into trees, and that's their panic survival response. If I actually relate to what she's asking me, I will die. And so they express it much more reasonably, much more calmly, but it's just as out of balance. You know, I can't, what do you feel? I don't know. Would you want to talk about it? No. You know, would you like me to help you understand? No. I mean, I don't want to just hack at the women here, you know. Yeah, is there anything? No. How was your day? Fine. But it's partly, of course, it plays on itself. If every time the tree begins to communicate, she turns into a chipmunk, the tree is not so anxious, right? So it's a very delicate line that we walk here. But on both sides, you know, when the man finds himself suddenly with a mental blank and has nothing to say, and you realize, which is so infuriating to the woman, that if anybody other than your wife asked you the same question, you would answer, right? Because you would never be that rude to anyone else. It's a very important point. That's what Swami mentions in his book. He mentions it so perfectly. He says, many times in our closest relationship, we behave in ways that we would never behave toward anybody else. This is the most precious person in the world to you. And you will do things and say things to them that you wouldn't say to your boss, to your secretary, to the clerk at the store, to the man who fixed your car, to your next door neighbor. No one in your life is privileged to get the kind of mistreatment that you reserve for the person who's most important to you. Out of some belief that this is this is one of the privileges of being close, is that now you don't ever have to discipline yourself. And it's a perfectly fine assumption. It's just, it kills the sweetness of your relationship. And the chapter this week is Growing Together, and Swami talks about courtesy and respect. But these are very, very, this is not popular, this is not the popular story about relationships. But it is the true story for anybody whose marriage you really admire. I promise you. Anybody's marriage you really admire, they understand this. Because you can't savage each other with your words or with your attitudes or with your coldness and just expect there to be any sweetness in it. This is not the popular story about relationships. But it is the true story for anybody whose marriage you really admire. I promise you. Anybody's marriage you really admire, they understand this. Because you can't savage each other with your words or with your attitudes or with your coldness and just expect there to be any sweetness in it. But what that means is you have to take a level of responsibility for yourself and a level of discipline for yourself that is difficult and somehow not part of the picture that we have of relationships. You know, in olden days, decades ago, when you greeted your husband or your wife by saying, good morning, Mrs. So-and-so, and how are you today? And you always referred to your husband as Mr. So-and-so, and there was this tremendous formality, at least on many levels. It was just understood. You know, you were just courteous. You didn't try to make this, and see, part of the problem is there's this very, because the extended family has broken down so much, and because people move so much, and it's so rare to have any like context for your life, there's this enormous necessity to make of that primary relationship everything. And so you, because it, come on now, that's all right. because it it has to be so much more than it ever can be, you just find yourself with no outlet. I don't know how else to say it. You know, there's just too much. Too much is resting on it. And if you're not getting along, there's no reality. And if the person is not cooperating with you, there's no reality. So you have these little nuclear families sitting, and many people, and I'm not talking to the people in this room, have no upward life either. And so it's just face to face, and it just, you fry in it. Because people are just not, the best of spouses is just going to be really different than you, in just ways that are just infuriating. There's just no other word for it. But just that simple understanding of courtesy and respect. Let me just sort of, I'm not saying it clearly enough, I'm just repeating myself. But Swami writes about it very interestingly, and I love the way he calls this chapter growing together. Is there any way to get more air conditioning in here? I mean, is it, it's real hot in here?
Yeah.
Well, it's real hot in here, yeah. Maybe we can shut the vents in the other rooms or something like that. Do you want to open up that one too, Brenda, right next to you?
It's pretty nice outside.
Yeah. But anyway, there's just a lot of people breathing and using up the...
up on top.
Yeah.
On the right. On the right.
I was noticing when I looked at the book that there's a later chapter called Communication. And this chapter is called Growing Together. You know, and yet a great deal of this chapter called Growing Together is really about communication. But what he's really talking about is he's talking about basic ground rules that'll hold your relationship together over a very long period of time. And that's why he starts with these very basic ideas of just really appreciating who the other person is and really respecting their right to be that way. And not having this thought of... again, the ideas of marriage, sometimes we get confused because we have a false idea from the start. We have this idea that because we're married, something is owed to me, and that you owe me a certain kind of intimacy, or you owe me a certain way of communicating. And even if you say that that's not how you feel, often there is that sense. And the woman who asked the question earlier, excuse me, I don't remember your name, but anyway, part of why we get so upset is because we have started defining our life by what this person is supposed to do. And when that person simply behaves according to their own reality, we feel betrayed. I was reflecting this morning, and I know I've said it to you many times already in this class, but I'm going to say it again, of what David said to me when he said, "Everything is fine until you get upset." And I know that people laugh whenever I say that, and I laugh myself, but I was just thinking it through all over again about how when a person makes a mistake, when somebody in your close proximity does something, a mistake, it's very rarely an intentional desire to do something awful to your life. Or even if it is an intentional desire to do something awful to your life, if they're fundamentally a good person having a bad moment, you know, it isn't really who they are. It isn't really what they want. But if we get this reaction to it and start thinking that now you have done something really horrible and revealed your true nature to me, and then go from that whole thing into this whole story about all the implications of that, when in fact somebody just had a bad moment, right? They didn't have a bad life, right? They just had a bad moment. But once you, the reactor, begins to start a cycle of reaction, it's very difficult to ever get it back. Okay, especially when it moves out of courtesy. Courtesy is such a funny word in this context, but it's such an obvious word. Because even if somebody in your life does something outside of your intimate relationships that you don't exactly like, generally speaking, it's assumed that you will behave with some restraint, right? And that you will just in some way perhaps need to rectify the situation, but there won't be that life-threatening experience, and so you'll behave somewhat with decency.